My name is Sue Conlon. I'm the Secretary of Peace and Progress. Peace and Progress is having a series of meetings this year. We had the first in Manchester in July. Under a sort of generic title of the struggle for human rights, but Sheffield, being independent-minded, decided to call this one Can Human Rights Survive? No problem with that. Towards the end of the meeting, I'm going to tell you about a proposal that has come through Peace and Progress to CAMPAC, the Campaign Against Criminalising Communities, for a month of action, or just over a month, in October and November, focusing on anti-terror laws and practices in the United Kingdom. And I hope that people here will join with Peace and Progress members in Sheffield to plan a number of activities there. Peace and Progress continues as a small party focusing on human rights to focus on the so-called war on terror. I'm well aware that Mr. Brown has decided to drop the term, but nothing else has changed as far as we're concerned. An apology that Emma Henney from Hugs, for whom all proceeds from today's meeting will go, is not well and is not able to join us. So apologies for that. So we have two speakers, Stephanie Harrison and Mohammed Abdul Malik, who I have difficulty calling that because I've known you for years as Abu Sondis, but I will introduce both of them separately at the relevant times. With all Peace and Progress meetings, the idea is to have as much discussion as possible, not for us to sit at the front, tell you what to think or what not to think. So both speakers will speak for no more than 20 minutes. I'll kick them under the table if they go beyond that. And then, apart from questions for clarification at the end of each speaker, I'm going to suggest we wait for both of them to speak and then open it up for discussion. And then at the end, I'll come back to this proposal that CAMPAC have developed in the hope that you will be interested in that. Just outside on the left as you go through these doors, if you've not already picked it up, take any of the material that is there. It's free to take. It gives you an idea of the thinking behind Peace and Progress. By way of an introduction, I actually want to refer to the first piece of more recent anti-terrorist legislation that there has been, which was the Terrorism Act of 2000. Because at the beginning of that act, it gives a definition of terrorism, where it says that terrorism means the use or threat of action where that use or threat is designed to influence the government or to intimidate the public or a section of the public, and the use of the threat is made for the purposes of advancing a political, religious, or ideological cause. It goes on to say that the action is to use violence. The term action defines that. But when it comes to the issue of government, where it says influencing the government, it is not limited to the government of the UK or the independent devolved parliaments that we have. Government, it says, means the government of the UK or part of the UK or of a country other than the UK. In other words, any country within the world whatsoever. And I know that Abdul Malik is going to speak in particular about Libya as president of Libya Watch. Now, it's interesting that we're holding this meeting at the week in which, in London, 2-3 days ago, this huge statue, 9-foot statue of Nelson Mandela, was unveiled by, amongst others, Ken Livingstone, and I'll come back to him a bit later. We all know, but just let me briefly repeat, because I think Nelson Mandela epitomises this issue of what is terrorism, what is a terrorist, as opposed to what is someone fighting against repression for a free and a democratic society, which is what he would say he always fought for by whatever means that he used. In 1956, he was charged with high treason, but eventually, after a 4-year trial, those charges were dropped against him. The ANC, of which he was one of the leaders, the African National Congress, was outlawed, or proscribed, as we might use the term now, under our terrorism legislation, in 1960, and he, with others, went underground. He was eventually arrested and charged with sabotage and attempting to violently overthrow the government. And we don't need any introduction to the apartheid regime in South Africa. And as we know, spent 27 years in jail before being released in 1990 and then becoming president of a free South Africa. When the statue was unveiled a couple of days ago, Gordon Brown hailed Nelson Mandela as, quote, the greatest and most courageous leader of our generation. And yet we know how much he was labelled a terrorist in the past for fighting against the vicious regime of apartheid. And it's what feeds peace and progress in terms of the agenda that we're pursuing at the moment is the fact that so much can change. When it comes to me introducing Mohamed Abdelmalek, I'm going to refer to the person we know leads that country at the moment, Colonel Gaddafi. Because Nelson Mandela was a pariah, but now is recognised as a huge international statesman. And something similar is happening in terms of Gaddafi being an image being created for him and the problem that he's creating. But also, it's who is a terrorist, who isn't a terrorist, is at the core, in a sense, of the anti-terror legislation and the practices that exist. Because some of the people that were struggling for freedom here or for their own countries against repressive regimes are now proscribed, are now outlawed in a way that they weren't before because they were seen previously as struggling for human rights. I'm going to introduce Stephanie Harrison, who is a human rights lawyer based in London, but thankfully, and the reason I invited, well, one reason I invited her is that she's from Sheffield, so I knew she could spend her time well in Sheffield, not just to come for this meeting. Apart from anything else, one of the areas of work that she deals with are what we sometimes call the national security cases, people under control orders, prescribed organisations under the Terrorism Act, and is therefore represented and continues to do so before what we call the Special Immigration Appeals Commission, SIAC. So I'm going to hand over to Stephanie. Thank you.
Yes, I've spent probably the vast part of the last 7 years working on various cases arising from legislation that's been introduced since 2000, so-called anti-terrorist legislation. And the question that's asked as the focus for this meeting, can human rights survive? It's obviously in that context where human rights have been tested to see whether they do provide the sort of protection and minimum guarantees that they were intended to provide by the individuals and the bodies who established the notion of fundamental rights coming after the Second World War through the UN Declaration of Human Rights and the European Convention on Human Rights. And it's in some respects a difficult question to answer, because before you get to decide whether human rights can survive, you have to have an idea about what human rights are. And in a sense, for me, there are two core ideas, and the central idea is that whoever you are, irrespective of your race, colour, creed, religion, conduct even, you have certain minimum entitlements that are part and parcel of the notion of what it is to be a human being. So they're indivisible rights that don't depend upon being a good person. They're not about, in the same way that we've had an agenda under the Blair years of rights and responsibilities, that your rights are conditional on whether you toe the line. They are fundamental to you as an individual, and everybody has them. And there can be no justification for violation of certain of those rights, in particular the right not to be subject to torture, inhuman or degrading treatment, to arbitrarily be deprived of your liberty, and other rights which can be fettered in certain circumstances, but only if there are very compelling reasons, which is the rights such as freedom of speech, association in your private life. So it's the indivisible nature of the rights, and the second factor that goes hand in hand in those is equality before the law. They're closely tied together, that whoever you are, you're entitled to these fundamental rights. And in a number of ways, those principles have been seriously put in jeopardy and under threat, at least since 2000, if not before, but certainly in the context of the terrorism legislation that the Labour government has introduced. And the critical piece of legislation, as Sue said, is the 2000 Act. And that marked a significant shift in the focus of the security forces' ideas about where a terrorist threat came from. Because prior to that, our legislation, our terrorist legislation, was entirely focused upon the north of Ireland and the conflict in that country. But from 2000, as Sue said, the notion of terrorism became a worldwide idea, that it could be come from any source and be directed at any government, not just the state of the United Kingdom. And it was because MI5 and the security forces saw that, anticipated in their minds, that the threat was going to come from groups outside of, within the United Kingdom, but who were seen to be from foreign or foreign communities, and predominantly from communities in the United Kingdom that had come to this country because of fears of persecution abroad within refugee communities. And that was their idea about who were the groups that they had to target, and that dictated quite a lot of the form of the legislation, in particular this extraordinarily wide definition of terrorism, covering any group, wherever they're focused, not necessarily at all in any way threatening the national security of the United Kingdom. And with that, within that legislation, there was a whole raft of measures. And Sue's picked up on what really are the critical measures. There was the measures that made it unlawful and potentially imprisonable with 10 years in prison if you were a member of a prescribed organisation. And those prescribed organisations were not set out in the legislation. What happened, just the power to prescribe was introduced through that legislation. And some months after the Act came into force, Parliament had before it an order where there were 21 organisations put on a list, and Parliament had to vote for the entire list. There was no question of analysing the individual groups that were on it. It was all or nothing. And there's very limited debate and discussion in Parliament. And this order was passed banning 21 groups, which had a whole array of different activities, different ideologies, and went from Al-Qaeda was one of the groups that was prescribed. But in addition to that, there were essentially national liberation movements based in the United Kingdom, like, for example, the PKK was banned. That's the Turkish Kurdish organisation. Other Turkish groups were also banned. The International Sikh Youth Federation, which was a group of Sikhs seeking self-determination from India. Hamas, a number of other Muslim organisations, Kashmiri groups, all of whom could be seen to be engaged in political activities against repressive regimes abroad. And they were the ones that then overnight their groups became illegal and you could no longer be a member. Not only could you not be a member, you couldn't be a supporter, so you couldn't hold a meeting and have a member, known member of ISYF or Hamas or whatever the group was. That's again carried a potential penalty of 10 years imprisonment, and you couldn't wear any insignia of the group. So for example, the PKK has a flag because it's a self-determination organisation. That flag became, to carry that flag on a march became a criminal offence. to where the face of their leader, Abdullah Öcalan, became criminal offence, 6 months in prison. So it was it's an absolutely draconian piece of legislation, and it has been used. And it's been used to prosecute Kurds for membership of the PKK. It's been used to prosecute another Turkish group it's a communist, it's called Devsol is its name. And they were, I don't know if you know anything about that group, but there was some series of hunger strikes of political prisoners in Turkey, many of whom were members of this banned organisation in the United Kingdom. So this group, support groups in the United, in London in particular, have a magazine that, and a lot of publicity and public meetings about what was happening to these hunger strikers and these political prisoners in Turkey. That group was banned, and a number of individuals were charged with terrorist offences, including membership of this banned organisation, and also for bringing into the UK their magazine, which is called Vatan. It's entirely lawful magazine, doesn't encourage violence, doesn't incite violence, it's informative, it's about the political struggles that are taking place in Turkey. That was the basis of a prosecution. Both those prosecutions failed, but they were an attempt to use this legislation to suppress legitimate political activity, certain community groups in this country. Other prosecutions did succeed. I'm aware of a prosecution of two members of the International Sikh Youth Federation who were based in Germany, and they came over to the United Kingdom in order to attend a meeting. And the group that they belong to is active in other European cities where there are Sikh communities. It's not banned, and these people were from Germany. It's not banned in Germany, but as soon as they crossed the channel and arrived in the United Kingdom, they became guilty of a criminal offence. They'd come here as members of this group to attend meetings, and they were prosecuted with membership of that organisation and were convicted and were sentenced to a term of imprisonment. And the ISYF sought to try to challenge the ban through the legislation that's set up, but unfortunately that didn't succeed. And so their members, including members from abroad, were at risk of prosecution. And the course that particular group took was to abandon the organisation and to set up under another group title, because obviously that's a practical way in which you can respond to the legislation. But it did have that effect that this group, which was has been established for over 25 years, and had historical political links in India, ceased to exist as a political organisation because of the effect on of the prosecutions and on the banning of the organisation. So prescription has been used, not particularly successfully in terms of the courts, but it has had an enormous chill effect on a number of vulnerable communities, like the Sikh community, and other communities that have more coherent or more cohesive political structures and ideologies, like the Kurds, have been much more able to defy the legislation. If you go to the Kurdish Community Centre on Kingsham Road in Hackney, you will see pictures of Abdullah Öcalan. They'll wear the flag and the insignia of their political organisations. And in fact, we helped organised a very large demonstration outside the Home Office against this legislation, where the T-shirts that everybody was wearing, including the children, said "I am PKK," as a defiance of the legislation. No one was prosecuted for doing that, although in principle it's a criminal offence. So the chill effect has been significant, but I wouldn't want you to go away from this meeting to think that it's succeeded across the board in inhibiting people's willingness and courage to continue with their political activities. It hasn't. And the Kurds are an inspiring example of a community very much under threat who have maintained their commitment to their political organisations in defiance of this draconian legislation. So That's the 2000 Act. And the next event which precipitated the further legislation was the bombing of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon in the United States, because, as I'm sure you're all aware, as a result of that, David Blunkett introduced speedily again through Parliament the 2001 Anti-Terrorism, Crime and Security Act, which introduced internment, detention without trial, exclusively for foreign nationals. And it was in that piece of legislation that you saw the beginning or crystallising the real attempt by the state, by the government, to say that there are some groups in this society who are not entitled to those minimum guarantees and are not entitled to equality before the law, because this was a measure introduced avowedly and accepted to be in breach of Article 5 of the European Convention on Human Rights, which is the article that protects the right to liberty. The government, in order to introduce the legislation, had to derogate, and that's a technical term that means they were suspending the protections of Article 5, which is possible to do that within the scheme of the European Convention if you can establish that there's a public emergency threatening the life of the nation. And the government were prepared to say that the events in New York and Washington were of such a magnitude that they threatened the United Kingdom's national security and were therefore justification for suspending the right to liberty for a particular section of the community, because they only applied to foreign nationals. If you're a British citizen, whatever your activity, whether you were plotting to blow up Downing Street, you couldn't be subject to this measure. David Blunkett made it clear to Parliament that he didn't think it was politically acceptable to subject British citizens to this kind of measure, and he was prepared barefacedly to say that to Parliament, and Parliament passed that legislation, which resulted in 12 men spending over 3 years in prison, for most of them the entire time in Belmarsh high security category A conditions in a special unit created for them. And clearly for that period fundamental rights for that particular group were suspended. The effect on those individuals was dramatic. Three of them ended up being transferred from mainstream prison to Broadmoor because of the effect on their mental health. And even when they were suffering from very severe mental health problems, and everybody agreed that they had such dramatic deterioration in their mental health that they could no longer be held in a prison, they weren't released. They went to Broadmoor, which for me is an extraordinary state of affairs. But that's what happened. And a number of the others, although they weren't as badly affected, clearly suffered significantly from being held in those kind of conditions for 3 years. That ended because the House of Lords said that the conditions, the measures didn't comply with fundamental human rights. And in particular, there was no rational justification for limiting a measure that was aimed at terrorist conduct to foreign nationals. There could be no satisfactory explanation for why anything turned on your nationality. It was irrelevant to the threat that you posed, because the evidence before the court was that the threat came from both British and foreign nationals. It wasn't that nationality didn't determine whether there was a group that were threatening the national security of the United Kingdom. And so the House of Lords dealt an important blow to the government's agenda of taking away and reducing the rights of foreign nationals in that judgment. One of the judges was also prepared to say that he didn't think that there was a public emergency threatening the life of the nation. All of the other judges upheld that, but Lord Hoffman's speech is powerful speech, in which he says that the biggest threat to our way of life and to our society is not the terrorist threat, but it's measures like this. It wasn't what you'd expect to get from 9 law lords sitting there in their ivory tower, but fortunately the 60 years of cases and statements from international bodies about the indivisible nature of fundamental rights and the equality before the law was the powerful tools that the lawyers were able to use to say this is gone too far. The government's response, though, was first of all not to release those men. They spent another 3 months in prison, but were then put under the regime of control orders, which I don't know if any of you are familiar with that, but this was a measure that was directly introduced to replace internment, and which has been used extensively to effectively place people under house arrest. And predominantly, again, it is foreign nationals who are subject to this measure, although the legislation itself doesn't now limit it to foreign nationals. British citizens can and have been subject to this legislation as well, although the majority of those British citizens are of Pakistan origin, of Muslim religion. That regime, now in place for 2 years, has resulted in people being held in their homes for up to 18 hours a day. And when I say homes, it's a flat. They're not allowed to go into the communal areas of the building. If they have a garden, they can't go in the garden. They cannot have visitors without approval from the Home Office. If in the limited time that they have outside of their home, again, they can't meet anybody. You can't have any pre-arranged meetings unless you're prepared to give the name of the person to the Home Office and a photograph and their date of birth and their address. So how many people are going to be willing to do that? Very few. And in fact, the vast majority of them have not been able to have meetings with friends because people inevitably are concerned not to be seen to be associating and to give all their details to the Home Office. So they live in a virtual prison, and extremely socially isolated. And again, so far, the courts have said that this extraordinary measure is not compatible with human rights, and that the restrictions on the person's freedoms are such as to constitute a deprivation of their liberty, again, which is not permitted by Article 5, and this time there's no derogation. So to date, the courts have quashed these orders for people who've been held for 18 hours, 14 hours and 12 hours in their own homes. Two of the 12-hour people have now spent 6 years on special measures because they were also interned in Belmarsh. But the House of Lords heard the case about an appeal against these judgments, and we're waiting the outcome. And I have to say that it doesn't look very promising, but we'll have to see. They might have said, we've gone so far with putting a stop to what the government's trying to do, but that's still to be seen what's going to happen. And then finally is the Terrorism Act 2000, which is an extraordinary piece of legislation that creates a whole raft of new criminal offences for conduct that couldn't otherwise be criminal conduct, all acts said to be preparatory to terrorism, and has been used extensively to prosecute people essentially for the material they have on their internet connection. And there's a lot of offences that are thought crimes, that are possession of material that interfere with freedom of speech. And we've seen prosecutions under that and the earlier legislation for essentially speech crimes, like Abu Hamza. He's got 7 years for the speeches that he's made. Other people have also been prosecuted. And so there is on the statute book a whole huge panoply of measures that are intended to control and to restrict not only criminal activity but otherwise lawful activity, And it would be right to say that the courts have made significant inroads and limited this legislation. And primarily they've done that because of the Human Rights Act and the implementation of the European Convention on Human Rights into domestic legislation. It has withstood some of the most excessive pieces of legislation that the government have introduced. But it's not a satisfactory situation. You can't depend upon the courts. And I think that experience has been, certainly, for example, with the prescription legislation, that the real way to resist these measures is for the people themselves who are directly affected, but with the support of other communities, to say that we're prepared to continue with our political activities and we're prepared to continue to associate with others, to discuss and to campaign about the issues that are important to us. Because using those rights, freedom of speech, freedom of association, is the only way to make them real. And they can be written on paper and the judge can look at them and lawyers can talk about them, but they don't mean anything unless real people are exercising them in their real lives. And it's that, in a way, that is the critical thing about these pieces of legislation, because otherwise they're focused on a very small number of people, but it's in their chill effect and in the message that they send out to people, criminalising large sections, potentially criminalising large sections of the community, that people become afraid and they tend to be in already vulnerable groups. But if there's anything that we can do to say, will human rights survive, it's got to be, even if it's in small numbers like this, of people who are prepared to say these communities under threat need support and they need to feel confident that they can exercise those rights. And I can certainly say from the experience of some of the community groups, not all of them, but some of them, they have been successful in resisting the chill effect of the legislation.
Thank you so much. I hate to use the word correction, but by mistake, I think you just said the last piece of legislation was 2000 again.
2006.
Whereas your notes say 2006,
oh,
for those who are
yes.
A little confused. Is there anyone who wants to ask a question just for clarification at this stage? I want to open up the discussion later on, once after Monica's spoken. Okay,
could you just say a little bit more about the case that's before the House of Lords?
Yes. The lower courts, the High Court and the Court of Appeal, have overturned control orders that have required people to stay in their homes for 12, 14 and 18 hours. There's three categories of case. And the High Court has ruled that in all those cases, it's an unlawful order because it deprives someone of their liberty. And although they're not locked in their house 24 hours a day, the conditions that they operate in are so akin to prison, if you think about open prison, where you can come and go, but ultimately the state is saying you must be here at this time and you've got to do this. And they have actually said that their restrictions on what they can do are more severe than open prison or even Category C prison. And because of the European Court case law, said that you have to look at all the circumstances. You don't have to have lock and key imprisonment to constitute the deprivation of liberty. The courts so far have said that these measures under the control order regime have gone too far and they do deprive people of their liberty. And so the orders have all been overturned. But the government appealed that decision, and in July the House of Lords heard that appeal. We're not very hopeful, actually, but we have to wait and see. I think probably one of the other issues that I haven't touched upon, but which is a key issue that arises in control order regimes and was under the Anti-Terrorism Crime Security Act, is about fair trial, because of course all these people are all the measures are based on reasonable suspicion. They don't have to prove anything. It's just MI5, make an assessment that you're involved in this kind of activity and you're a threat, and that's sufficient for you to have these measures taken against you. And you don't get jury, you don't get the Crown having to prove their case. All it is a reasonable suspicion. And so the court, the House of Lords, also heard arguments about whether people have a fair trial and whether there are any minimum entitlements, because a lot of the evidence that's used against people under these regimes, these kind of quasi-criminal prosecutions, is all in secret, and you never get to know what the case is against you. It's a surreal, Kafkaesque scenario, and the court also is deciding about whether that's compatible with fair trial rights. And again, that looks unlikely that we're going to succeed with that.
Parallels with the USA, because recently George Bush has had to, they've had to change the habeas corpus law, haven't they? People in Guantanamo Bay, for example, didn't have the right to challenge the legality of their detention. Is that similar here? Do you have the? Is there a human right to be able to challenge the people that are detaining you?
Yes, there is. That's right. Yes,
and that's part of human rights.
That's part of Article 5. Is the right that protects persons from deprivations of their liberty, from imprisonment, and it also requires there to be recourse to a court to challenge the legality of your detention.
Right.
So that's Article 5.4, and that reflects our common law domestic right, which is habeas corpus, to go to the court to say I'm unlawfully detained.
Mm-hmm. Have anybody challenged the detentions on those grounds?
Well, that was the basis on which we challenged the control order regime. We said this is detention. And this is imprisonment, and we're entitled to have it overturned and to have the courts consider it.
Mm-hmm.
But under the 2001 legislation, that right was suspended. That was the effect of the derogation, so that you couldn't say that you were unlawfully detained, and you couldn't go for habeas corpus either. So, But it still had to be...
So has there been a challenge made on that?
We did challenge that, and we succeeded. But the reason why we succeeded was because although the European Convention allows you to suspend the protections for liberty, it's only in very limited circumstances, and the measure that you introduced, it has to be proportionate. And what that means is that it has to meet the aim that you... It has to be rational, it has to be sensible measure, and it has to not interfere with rights more than is necessary. And the court thought that it wasn't rational because it was only limited to foreign nationals, and it went too far because they weren't having to lock up British citizens, so why do you have to lock up foreign nationals? There's other measures, maybe surveillance or security measures, prosecution, the obvious thing. Why isn't that good enough for foreign nationals? And they never had, the government had no proper answer to that.
And just the 21 prescribed organisations, when was that voted in Parliament?
That was March 2001.
So that's before 9/11?
Yes.
And it's known that Al-Qaeda operatives were moving in and out of Britain at the time, and they were a prescribed organisation.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think that it probably has any, it wouldn't have any effect on any group that's determined to carry out illegal acts, but it will have effect on those that are above board and that are active. Because that's nobody's going to be holding a meeting.
Sorry. It seems to have been selected because British intelligence knew that Al Qaeda operatives were moving in and out of Britain.
Yes.
And they will let them do it.
Yes.
So it seems like they're selective about how they're going to hit on a certain organisation. If they're picking on the Sikhs.
Yes.
So they'll leave Al Qaeda moving in and out of the country fine.
Yes, well, I think that maybe it's the other speaker will talk about that, but what you can see is that the groups that they have targeted are groups where there are diplomatic relations or economic interests that the government's seeking to foster. Libya is a critical example, and I'm sure that the speaker will talk about that. But the other groups, the Indians wanted to have the ISYF banned.
So it's a diplomatic.
It's quid pro quo politics. You ban our opponents, and we'll do this for you. In other countries, like for example Algeria, where the groups from Algeria were banned, GIA, other groups like that, in exchange for cooperation with Algeria, including in the context of deportations of citizens, refugees from here, there have been trade negotiations, and Britain has, we've discovered through the proceedings involving the deportation of Algerian nationals, over £6 billion worth of aid going to Algeria at the time that they were seeking to get them to agree these memorandum of understanding to facilitate the deportation of people who otherwise wouldn't be able to be deported because there's evidence that they'd be tortured there. So there's a lot of real politics that goes on, that this is part and parcel of the quid pro quo for other favours, international favours, yes.
There's plenty of time for discussion again afterwards. So let's move on. I mentioned at the beginning about Nelson Mandela, and partly in preparation for today's meeting, I was looking again at part of his book, Long Walk to Freedom, and about the period of time that he spent in Robben Island and other prison facilities. And reading the description of, you know, he could only have one family visit for 30 minutes every 6 months, one letter every 6 months. It's just amazing in some ways that you're reading something that's so similar to the restrictions that some of these men have faced. I work in an office with a lawyer called Natalia Garcia, who works with Stephanie on these national security cases. And I, as a result of working in the same department as Natalia, I sign in post, I sign out post. And you see the restrictions when we're dealing with the control order contact officers. You know, if a man wants to take, who's under control order, wants to take his daughter to the dentist, has to say exactly who the dentist is, where the address is, what time is the appointment, and they will give time to leave that his home at that time, and he must be back by this time. So God help you if the dentist is delayed. You know, it's petty, whereas it would be farcical if it wasn't so serious. And the continuing deterioration in mental health that continues is amazing. The actual group of 21 has now expanded. It's at least 25.
Yeah.
And Caged Prisoners, an organisation you may know of, has said that at least 18 of the 25 are Muslim organisations, which is significant in itself. But it shows you how things have developed, and this brings us on to Mohammed Abdelmalek. 7th of July... Sorry?
Abu Sandis.
It's easy to say. 7th of July 2005, we know what happened in London when over 50 people were killed.
Yeah.
Okay, there's some argument about who was responsible, but they say four British men of Pakistani origin were the suicide bombers on that occasion. Okay. That's who the government decided, and that's it. Within a month of the 7th of July 2005, Tony Blair was on the phone to Colonel Gaddafi of Libya, trying to speed up the negotiations about entering into this memorandum of understanding, this agreement that would enable Britain to deport Libyan nationals who were considered a security risk here, on the understanding they would not be tortured if they were returned to Libya. Why do that? Libyans were not suspected of being involved in the bombings in London of the 7th of July 2005. The 1st of September is significant for Libyans. 38 years ago, to this day, Colonel Gaddafi came to power. 1st of September 1969. And quite possibly, if he wasn't here today, Abu Sandis would be at the demonstration outside the Libyan embassy in London, which they've had now for a few years, where those opposed to the regime protest rather than celebrate the coming into power of Colonel Gaddafi. We've mentioned already the continuing links between Libya and the UK and how this works. Just let me give you an example of recent developments between Britain and the UK. Tony Blair met Colonel Gaddafi for the first time, 25th of March 2004, as part of his farewell tour. He met him again recently when they announced this new BP oil deal. Mike O'Brien, another minister, April 2004, Baroness Simmons, the Duke of Kent, Hilary Benn, Charles Clarke, Kim Howells, Foreign Office, minister, all visited. The most recent visit was Kim Howells, again Foreign Office Minister, who had a speech on the 30th of July 2007 when they were discussing cooperation between Libya and the UK. He said, apart from anything else, Libya is to be congratulated on its determination to change its relationship with the rest of the world. It's not been an easy process for them, but by transforming that relationship, Libya has opened up huge new opportunities for itself. We're here today because we want to help Libya grasp those opportunities. And they're looking, therefore, at the basis for a new relationship, for promotion, where they say here about human rights, the promotion and protection of human rights is important to maximise economic prosperity. That was Kim Howells, 30th of July. And he talks then at that time about the cooperation on issues such as economic, migration. We're going to teach Libya how to make sure migrants and refugees don't get the support they need. And he said at the end of his speech, Libya, in promoting tolerance and moderation, is a key partner in the fight against extremism and bigotry. Now, just briefly before I hand over to Abu Sandis, when the Memorandum of Understanding with Libya was challenged recently before the Special Immigration Appeals Commission, and this document is one of those you'll find outside, you might look at it and think, it's nothing to do with me. Take it and read it, because it shows you the thinking behind the British government in the way that it's developing these agreements and the way it's trying to get out of its obligations under the Human Rights Convention. But this, just one quote from this judgment where they said, actually, Libya's not safe. Despite this memorandum of understanding, Libya is not safe to return suspected international terrorists to. And SIAC, but when it comes to this issue of what is terrorism and whether people like Abu Sandis, who are seeking to bring about a change in what most sensible people would say is a despotic dictatorship, you're restricted. What the SIAC said is the risk of violent action against Libya and its interests, supported by the UK-based Libyan Islamist extremists, is legitimately to be taken as a threat to the UK's national security. It's a bit like the hit on the Twin Towers is a threat to our security. Attack against Libya is a threat to our security. And it says the reason it's a threat is because of the desire of the UK government to retain the newly improved relations with Libya and the advantages which cooperation in countering Islamist terrorists brings to UK security. Advancing that cooperation and disrupting that threat to the Libyan regime assists the UK's national security interest. Just one thing before I hand over. One of the people who campaigned for the statue of Nelson Mandela for several years to be there was Ken Livingstone, Mayor of London. When Kim Howells spoke on the 30th of July about this increasing cooperation between Libya and the UK, he announced that Ken Livingstone, who was the Mayor of London, he said, I'm therefore very pleased that next year the Lord Mayor of London will lead a trade delegation to Libya to develop the growing ties in the banking and investment sectors. Mohammed Abdul Malik Abu Sandis, whichever name we know him as, has been active in Libya, outside of Libya. I can't remember the last time you were in Libya. Not for a very long time.
I can't remember either. Can't remember. 25 years ago.
I'm very glad he's been able to be with us today. I phoned him yesterday to have a chat about today's meeting, and I got the international dialing code, and I thought, oh no, he's not here. But he's flown back from Italy to come to be with us today. And I'm very grateful that he's here with us. He's president of Libya Watch. That's just his current kind of configuration. He's been active for many years. And he's going to speak to us particularly about the situation in Libya, but also the situation for Libyans in Britain. Thank you.
Thank you. It is a pleasure to be here today. And thank you, Sue, for your introduction. 28 years ago today, Colonel Gaddafi came to power. And since then, over those 38 years, he has systematically and continuously and persistently eroded, I won't say human rights, I would say everything that is decent. The title, Can Human Rights Survive? I think that applies to the West. in places like Libya, it has human rights haven't been born yet, let alone for them to survive. They don't exist, and therefore when we work in relation to human rights, we are on a different level of perception than what most people living in the West are. For example, I was once invited to be on a program on Al Jazeera channel regarding the European law that phone companies, mobile and landline companies, must by law keep a record of all communications for 5 years. And I don't mean the actual conversation, I mean the log, phone number so and so called, phone number so and so, the duration of the call was for so long, and the call took place from this city to that city, or that sort of thing. And it seemed that the people in the program thought that the law gave permission to the MI5 and MI6 to keep tabs on people. And I told her, this was alive, this was on national satellite. I told her that that is not the case, because MI5 has always kept tabs on people and they don't need a law to do that. And this is only a requirement for the civil companies to keep records. And then she said, then what's the problem? Why is all the fuss? And that's exactly it. Well, to us, to people living in the East, people living in the East will never understand why the British people are opposed to ID cards. They just won't understand. What's the fuss? Why are you opposed to ID cards? What's wrong with them? So the level of perception that we talk about is totally different. Please understand this. I think Sue has pointed to this. In one case, for example, in front of a judge in an immigration case, in an asylum case, a film which was prepared by the National Front for the Salvation of Libya was shown to the judge. And the film contained scenes of people being hanged, and this was public hanging in Libya after an attempt by the National Front for the Salvation of Libya, which failed. These people were actually executed, hanged, in public, and it was broadcasted by the Libyan TV in Ramadan, right at the time of breakfast, which is sunset. When people are having their meal, they open the Libyan TV and they see these scenes of their children being hanged publicly. And the judge didn't believe the film. He said, no, this is fabricated. I can't believe it. Mm-hmm. One of the comments that a journalist has written on the incident that took place in St. James Square in London in 1983, WPC Yvonne Fletcher got shot in it and killed. He said that when the automatic fire was fired from the Libyan embassy in London, that the demonstrators, a few Libyans, maybe 12, 15 or something like that, the minute the shooting started, they all ducked, while passerbys in St. James Square just froze. They didn't know what to do, because no Englishman expects, in St. James Square from an embassy for someone to start firing automatic shots. But we do. So that's the I want to establish this difference of the perception. On the theme of anything that is decent, I'll just give you an example of... I left Libya in 1982. In 1981 and 82, when I went to visit a family, usually when you go and visit a family, you know, visit people, you take a box of chocolate, you take some sweets, you take some sort of gift. You know what I used to take with me? You won't believe this. I would take with me one lamp, you know, light bulb, one light bulb or two light bulbs. And we're talking about an oil-rich country here. Because at that time, I was very lucky. I had some inside information. And I went and bought a lot of light bulbs, because I knew that none are coming to Libya. And there was none in the market. And there are some households that only had one light bulb, and they moved it from the living room to the bedroom to the kitchen, hoping that it will not, you know. And when I went to visit them and I took a light bulb to them, they would be very happy. So it's that sort of level. The level of, you go to hospital, for example, and not only are you asked to provide your own blood for blood transfusion should you need it, but you will be asked to provide your own needles. You provide your own stitching material, you know, when if you've got a wound, you, they just don't have it. They don't have the needles for syringes. They don't have the stitching line. Things like that. People sleeping to a bed in hospital. Many people nowadays, many people in this oil-rich country that has maximum 5 million people in it, that is 8 times the size of the UK, when they need to have an appendicitis operation, appendix, they might sell a piece of land, or they might sell their car, or they might sell the jewelry of the wife simply to go to Tunisia or to go to Jordan. If you happen to go to Tunisia, keep a lookout for Libyan car plates, and you will find them mainly around clinics in Tunisia, wherever you go. In Tunisia and in Jordan, this country, this oil-rich country, does not provide a decent health care system. And that's why when we hear all the fuss about the health care system in the UK, we can't understand what's the problem. What's the problem with the UK health system? It's fine, it's excellent, it's fantastic. Education is likewise. Education is a mess in Libya. It is really a mess. Everything is a mess in Libya. There's a law, law number 15, for example. This law froze the salaries. When I left Libya, when I graduated back in 1979, the average salary for a new graduate, a teacher, an engineer, is about 150 Libyan dinars. At that time, at the change rate, 150 Libyan dinars equaled £300 sterling. That was back in 1979. Today, a new graduate who is lucky to find a job and is an accountant or an engineer or a teacher gets 150 Libyan dinars, the same price, except that today at the change rate, 150 Libyan dinars equals £60 sterling. Okay? So the abuse is not only on the things that we take for granted, imprisonment, freedom of expression. No. It's far worse than that. Of course, when we come to imprisonment, Abu Slim, the infamous Abu Slim massacre, for example, in which 1,200 political detainees were killed, were massacred in about 4 or 5 hours in the prison. How do we know the number? We know the number because the contractor who supplied the meals to the prison, his supply of meals dropped on that day, 1,200 meals. 1,200 meals. He was asked not to, you know, to drop his supply of the meals by 1,200. And we have managed to get about 500 names of the people who have been massacred. We've got witnesses, of course, to the massacre and things like that. Law number 45, which is called the Law of Honor, for example. The Law of Honor gives the government, the Libyan government, the right to punish the family of dissidents, group punishment. For example, one particular person in Benghazi, right in front of my in-law's house, he lives right in front of them. His family, because of him, his family were taken out of the house and their home was demolished with everything in it. All the furniture, all their stuff, all their utensils, everything in it. The house was demolished. And this is the punishment that was handed down to his family because of what his, their son has done. And the demolishing of homes has happened across Libya in more cases than one. Law of Honor, Abu Slim, executions, I've spoken about executions. The other thing is that this reign of terror has spilled over to the West. It began when Gaddafi called for the execution of what he termed as stray dogs. And stray dogs are all people who oppose him, who managed to escape the country and are living in the West, they are called stray dogs. Yeah, we jokingly call those who follow him as tame dogs. So the stray dogs, there was a program in Libya where he called for the execution of stray dogs, and this led to a number of executions in public, well, executions, sending people, sending assassins and killing these people in the West, a number of assassinations in Athens, in Rome, and the other cities of Italy, and in London. In 1981, if I'm not mistaken, one of the broadcasters of the Arabic BBC radio was assassinated in front of the mosque, the central mosque in London, right after Jum'ah prayer. He was coming out with his son, I believe, when a young man walked up to him and just shot him. And this happened in London. There was a bombing in Manchester. They were hoping to get the Bin Galbun's family. Bin Galbun family are a family that is associated to the old king, the old deposed king. And there was an attempt on their life as well at that time. And then, of course, there was the nightclub in Berlin. And then, of course, there was the Lockerbie bombing. And that was when Gaddafi, and of course WPC of Yvonne Fletcher, who was shot from the Libyan embassy, all this led to political relationship becoming very stressed with Britain and with America and the world. And eventually Libya was put on a boycott, and Colonel Gaddafi went into the cold, but suddenly he has emerged from the cold in a very clever thing. Because of Iraq, the West, mainly Bush and Tony Blair, were looking desperately for anything that would save their face, because there were no weapons of mass destruction. Why are we attacking Iraq? Because of weapons of mass destruction. Because Iraq is a threat to the UK. But suddenly there are no weapons of mass destruction. So any ethical excuse for invading Iraq failed. But suddenly Colonel Gaddafi comes and says, okay, I'm giving up my program of weapons of mass destruction, which I don't believe he had any, definitely not a nuclear program anyway, maybe a chemical program, but then again, a chemical program, who can't have a chemical program of weapons of mass destruction, chemical and biological? That's very easy. That's the poor man's nuclear bomb. So he gave it up, and that was the beginning of him coming back into the, well, coming out from the cold and joining the respectability of the world. However, I feel that sometimes people in my position who's been living in the UK for 25 years, sometimes I feel I'm British, which I am. Sometimes I feel I'm Libyan. And sometimes I feel that as a British person, as a British citizen, I feel that the governments of the West, Britain and the United States, sometimes they tend to take us for fools. They tend to think that we're stupid, especially as someone in my position, because when America and Blair claim that there is a connection, for example, between Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, and what's his name of Iraq, Saddam Hussein, that is a joke. That is a joke. People who do not know might, yes, well, Saddam Hussein is an Islamicist, he talks about jihad, he's this, he's that, and therefore there is a link here between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden. But to me, That's like they just don't mix, like mixing oil and water. Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden can never go together. Osama bin Laden is opposed to everything that Saddam Hussein presents, and therefore when the power that we in the West tells us that there is a link, to me that is simply taking us for fools. And that makes me very, very angry. And that makes me distrust anything that comes from these politicians. I just don't trust them. And the other thing is that we get things like Guantanamo Bay, which has been mentioned, and we get Abu Ghraib's prison, and we get these things that has happened. And these things make us lose trust in the powers that be in the West. Most Arabs and most Muslims do not distinguish between the different parts of the West. The West to them is one. Yeah, the ordinary people, the organizations that are opposed to these policies, and the government, and the thinkers, and the all parts of the West are one, are seen to be one, and therefore they do not see the good part of the West that is in play against these evil forces, if I may call them as such. The other thing that comes out of this also is that if Colonel Gaddafi can do it, well, I've got to. If Colonel Gaddafi can do it, sorry, if Bush can do it, if America can have its Guantanamo Bay, then why not Libya? If to capture 7 Libyans in Manchester, 500 officers are deployed. 500 officers were used to capture, to arrest. When you enter to someone's house by force, what's that?
Illegal.
Definitely.
To raid
7 families, right? And these families were made up of a wife, children, and the suspect. And in some cases, the suspect actually was signing in the police station the day before. And they raided his house at 3 o'clock in the morning. In some cases, 15 men were inside the bedroom of a woman. 15 officers were inside the bedroom of this poor woman, who is usually wears the niqab. She's covered from head to toe, and she's in her bedroom under the blanket. She's forced to go out of the bed, and she's not allowed to even cover herself with the bed sheet. In some cases, in a particular case, she was pregnant. This woman was pregnant. She started bleeding because she was mishandled by the police, who were all wearing balaclavas and using foul language. So the situation is really, really terrible. We spoke about some control orders, for example, and I know a case where this guy, who's under a control order, has mental problems, and he wants to see the counselor. His GP has referred him to the counselor. He can't go and see the counselor. He needs to apply to the Home Office. And the Home Office has actually spoken to the GP, got back to the GP through the solicitor, saying, why does he need to see the counselor once every week for 6 weeks? And the answer is that is pretty much standard. That's what it's done. You go and see the counselor once a week for 6 weeks. That's what the National Health Service package is. You might need more than 6 weeks. You might need less than 6 weeks. But you're given 6 weeks, and they're not very happy with it. They know that's too much. He shouldn't go and see his counselor once every week for 6 weeks. And definitely not when so-and-so are also coming to the a GP. So if there's an emergency case and this guy is in the GP, then we can't have the other two or three Libyans come to the GP, even if it's an emergency case, because otherwise this will be in breach of the laws of the control order. Now, the other thing is that I want to to speak about is that, unlike the English proverb or the English saying that it is the English saying, the saying that no man's is an island, and that holds true. Because even though these legislations that we've heard about, what is going on in Libya and that sort of thing, is not happening to us, the British citizens living in this country, but that's only a matter of time. Very soon, because that's the nature of these politicians, they will lie through their teeth, they will put cases in front of the House of Lords simply so that you can't refuse a list with 21, the top of whom is Al-Qaeda. You can't let Al-Qaeda go through, even if it means, you know, having in its wake 24 other organizations, some of whom might be innocent. Because at the end of the day, if you have a list that includes Al-Qaeda, then that list is going to go through. So the politicians have their ways and means, frankly. And therefore, we need to understand that politicians will erode at our civil liberties bit by bit, until suddenly we discover that we are at the receiving end of their injustice. And therefore it's better to stand up now for the rights of these others, so that our own rights don't get don't be next. The other thing that I want to talk about is this memorandum of understanding. The memorandum of understanding is signed by Abdullah Ibrahim Al-Ubaidi, on behalf of the Libyan government. Now, to me, as a Libyan, being involved in the political arena and in the human rights arena for so many years, it means nothing. It's not even worth the ink with which it's written. Simply because in Libya, the only person who matters is Colonel Gaddafi. If something is signed by, and even Colonel Gaddafi himself, one of the comments that was made in a Channel 4 program is that Colonel Gaddafi, they said that if a politician or a government makes one U-turn on policy, it resigns. Colonel Gaddafi has made a career out of U-turns. Okay? So, nothing that comes from Libya can be trusted. Nothing. There was this case where Shaker came on the BBC and he said that we only paid for the compensation of Lockerbie so that the problem will go away. But we are not responsible for Lockerbie. He said this on the BBC. Immediately he said this, the West went up in uproar. How could you say this? And Shaker was the prime minister at that time. The next day, Shalgam, who is the foreign secretary, comes out in the media and says that the prime minister is wrong. Now we'll have the foreign secretary claiming that the prime minister is wrong, he's not right, we are responsible for Lockerbie, and that is the official stance. Even though Colonel Gaddafi has been saying this all the time. Shaker only repeated what Colonel Gaddafi said. The only difference is that Shaker said it to the BBC. Colonel Gaddafi has been saying it to the Libyan people. The Libyan people don't matter. If you say it to the Libyan people, it's okay. It doesn't matter. Don't say it to the West. It's a bit different issue altogether. And therefore, we need to stand up for these people's rights, for our rights, so that the human rights in the West can survive. Let us give the Libyan people and the rest of the world some decency, so that our liberties, our human rights here in the West can survive. We can do a number of things. In case of Libya, this can apply to the Kurdish, can apply to different organizations. We can write letters and see our MPs. We can write letters to the media. There is most likely there will be an article in the Mail on Sunday tomorrow about Muhammad Abdullah Sunusi, who has beaten up some some prostitutes, I think, in London, and he was accused of grievous bodily harm, and there was a lot of pressure applied, and he came in a Rolls Royce, and Muhammad Abdullah al-Sunusi is the son of Abdullah al-Sunusi, and Abdullah al-Sunusi is the mastermind of the Abu Slim massacre I told you about. He's one of the henchmen of Colonel Gaddafi, very highly connected in the Libyan, and a lot of pressure has been applied, and eventually the case has been dropped, and Muhammad has walked out freely. I think there will be an article on it tomorrow, which you can read. The other thing that we can do is we can write letters to Colonel Gaddafi himself and to Saif, and this is very important because Colonel Gaddafi cares about his image, and he sees himself as, you know, the champion of the people. He prides himself in being liked by the masses everywhere, especially the Asians. They love him, right? So if we can get you guys to write letters to Colonel Gaddafi, and encourage people to write letters to Colonel Gaddafi, I think that would help, because there's we hope there would be a lot of change in Libya. A lot of change, simply because we think that Colonel Gaddafi will be trying to hand down power to his son. And the only way he can do that is if he enforces some kind of system in the country whereby the handing down of power will be possible. Because now, if Colonel Gaddafi is removed, there will be 21 people claiming power after him. And I think the country could easily fall into civil war, or into something like Iraq, and that is something that we definitely don't want. Thank you for listening. I hope I've been able to contribute to the... If I may...
I'm going to stop you.
Okay, that's fine.
Because there may well be other points that you can make, sure. Other points you'll think of. I'll give you time, sure, to get your thoughts, yeah, together. That's a polite way of putting it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Stephanie was saying earlier, just to bring these two things together, about the ways in which some of these individuals, the community groups, have found ways around it. And in really, so it's the best way to challenge some of these measures is by those groups continuing to do what they were doing anyway. I've met over the last few months with a number of the Libyans, both those who were affected by those raids that Avisondis has spoken about, including the women. And some of them are former clients of mine who have, I've assisted them to get refugee status, and I've looked at one or two of them, and they've been so haunted in their expressions now that I've actually said to them, did we do the right thing? Now obviously we did in providing place protection, but that's seriously undermined whether they're now British or not. But when I was saying to him, you must tell people your story. You must let people know what has happened. You know, a teenage boy in one of those seven families who was made to kneel on the floor with a gun at his head, who now is terrified. You know, that's you know, every family has got its story there. And that's just seven families in Manchester. And how many more times is that repeated? I don't know if it's happened in Sheffield. It certainly happened in Birmingham. And that's partly what we're proposing, this... Okay, we're saying month of action. It's an ongoing thing, but at least this concerted thing that I'm going to come back to at the end. But I was in Manchester recently, and I was speaking not with those families affected, but with other Libyans. And Abby Saunders was mentioning that these women were not allowed any dignity during the time of that arrest. And I'm sure Abbasonis will correct me if I'm wrong. Whether or not they were a member of those families that were affected, all the Libyan women now sleep fully clothed in their beds.
Manchester. That's what I do.
But the women, none of them go to bed now in their bedclothes. Whether or not they were part of those raids, because they are all absolutely terrified. For them, in some ways, that indignity of being dragged out by these fully masked people who they could only see the eyes, and as Abu Sandi said, 500 officers for seven families. Absolutely terrifying. And unfortunately, it's that pattern that is continuing to be repeated across the country. Not necessarily just with now foreign nationals, some of them in fact were British. And they were better off to some extent, but they're still living the nightmare. And one of the reasons for HUGS, Helping Households Under Great Stress, being the organisation for which this is a benefit, is because I know Emma Henney, amongst others, is doing vital work supporting those families, the women in particular, through the trauma. And that's why we want some money to go to them, to support it, to provide assistance. But it's partly that if these people are not free to speak, not just about their own situation, but about bringing human rights to Libya for many, many, many years, then how can others do it for them? It can't. It's got to come from the Libyan people itself. Just one illustration, as Abisson has said at the beginning of his talk, of the difference between Libya and the UK. Saif is one of Colonel Gaddafi's sons. Commonly believed that he's going to be the one who takes over from Colonel Gaddafi. Some years back, I don't remember the date, he's a keen football player and football supporter. Has he actually bought a football team?
No, not him, that's his brother.
Right, okay.
It's Sheffield Wednesday, yeah. Better be fair.
He was at a football match supporting his team. Supporters of the opponent's team used the opportunity to display, it's said, a few Islamist slogans. Saif gave permission for his bodyguards to open fire. 50 people killed at a football match. That's just one little illustration of the difference. And Saif recently interviewed on Al Jazeera. If any of you know about the Bulgarian nurses and the Palestinian doctor that were convicted twice for the murders, for infecting children with AIDS in Benghazi, God help us to think it might be hospital conditions in Libya that might have led to that. He has said he accepts that those Bulgarians, foreign nationals in Libya, were tortured, and that most of them were women. There's only one man amongst them. Let's open this up. We've got 20 minutes. So I think we have to be out of here at 4.
We can go over. Can we? Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
Any questions, comments, whatever. And it's not just from you to people here. It's for all of us to join in that discussion.
Israel is it? Was a website with information on Libyan situation today and political background for a real understanding of what Gaddafi's politics is about, who is protesting against him, where the religious connections are and so on. Because I don't have enough knowledge at this moment to write a letter to Gaddafi about a change of situation. I need some food to use. Is there such a thing?
There is a problem in relation to Libya, is that officially Libya does not publish any information. The Libyan government does not publish any information about Libya. So you won't get any form of statistics at all officially from the Libyan government, but you can get information from the opposition, from human rights organizations. Amnesty International has a lot of information about Libya. Human Rights Watch, for example, has a lot of information. Unfortunately, our web page is not on now, but we also, Libya Watch, has Libya Watch Libya, www.libya-watch.org. You won't be able to get it now. We're trying to get it back. You will find a lot of information about that. So if you go on Google or any search engine and Libya, you will get some information about that. Yeah.
Can I just add one thing to that, which is that Amnesty International did an analysis of all of the countries where the United Kingdom is seeking these memorandum of understanding, these assurances about torture on return. And they did, and that included, because Libya is one of the countries, a whole detailed information summary of the political situation and human rights problems in Libya. But it also covers the other countries, Jordan, Algeria, and Tunisia, where they're seeking assurances. So you would definitely find stuff about Libya from Amnesty. It's very good.
The other thing about this is that We've organized a number of conferences which have been very successful. And the reason why they're very successful is because the Al Jazeera and the Al Arabiya satellite channels came and took pictures and had interviews with us and aired them. And in one of those conferences, Saif himself responded immediately by denying that there were human rights abuses in Libya and ending up accepting that there were human rights abuses in Libya. They are impulsive. That's the Colonel Gaddafi and his son Saif are the same. They're impulsive. They might, you know, say something on the spur of the moment without thinking, without going back, without, you know, that's the kind of mentality that they have, that they own Libya. It's theirs. They can decide on the spot of the moment to say whatever. They feel they like. So, on one of these conferences, we decided to shift the focus from killing, disappearance, imprisonment, to other finer human rights aspects, education, health, journalism. And one of the comments I had from one of the Al Jazeera journalists was that it's boring. It's boring. Who wants to go and, you know, watch a conference about human rights abuses in education, human rights abuses no, we want blood, we want killing, we want, you know, that sort of thing, that sort of thing that attracts the media. And unfortunately, without the media, without our voice being taken by, you know, like the Al Jazeera satellite channel, then we might as well be, you know, shouting in the middle of the desert.
Can I just ask a follow-up question? I have met quite a lot of Libyans here in Sheffield because I teach English as a foreign language, mm-hmm. and a lot of them are at the university studying over the years. And I meet their dependents who come to learn English while husband and wife is studying. And what I'm aware of in this case, as in every other country that we're talking about, which is why the whitelist is so damning, is that if your face fits, your country is wonderful. The picture that is painted when talking with the Libyans that I meet is of a wonderful country with a great history and a great social scene, etc. So what I'm really wondering is I would like to know about who are the protesters? Who are the people who are protesting against this, who are the victims of this reign of terror, and who are the protesters? And that I will find in the Amnesty.
In June 2005, there was a major opposition conference, Libyan opposition conference, held over 2 days in London, which brought together groups like National Front for the Salvation of Libya, etc., about six organisations. I don't just mean in the UK, USA, Europe as well, came together. And they formed, if I remember the title correctly, the National Committee for Libyan Activities. And there's a UK branch of that. Now, I don't know, again, if they have a website. But there is information available. National Committee for Libyan Activities.
It doesn't have a web page as such, but again, if you go into the opposition web pages like Al Mustaqbal. I don't know how to spell it.
You're going to have to give the spelling.
Yeah.
If you let me have your contact details, yeah. I'll get you some.
There are many reasons for the picture that they paint. To start with, Libya is a beautiful country. It's a very beautiful country, and it's opening up for tourism now, and the coastline is practically sold to international foreign companies, and it's going to be raped, frankly speaking. And how much will the Libyan people themselves benefit from this is very little. But the political system and the social system was beautiful before Colonel Gaddafi. For example, bribery was unheard of in my country. Now bribery is rife in my country. You can't live, a family can't live on £60 a month. No way. So people are, you know, they have to have two jobs, they have to, by any means, by hook or by crook, they need to have a living. However, these Libyans who are lucky enough to get a scholarship to come and study in Britain are not going to spoil it for themselves simply by telling you what is going on in their country. They won't do it. That's number one. Sometimes, mostly it's because they are afraid, especially if you speak to them collectively in a group. Maybe if you speak to them individually, they might open up. But in front of each other, they will never say anything against their country or against Gaddafi or against the Libyan regime ever. The other reason that they might defend their country is misplaced national pride, that sort of thing. They don't want you as a foreigner to get the impression that their country is bad.
Yes, I think I'm not so much concerned with them because I know that every country's got people who are satisfied with the situation.
Yes.
What I'm interested in is the people who are fighting, the people who are being victimized, the people who come here to seek asylum and they're not mistreated here.
Well, there's one guy who's in Guantanamo, Omar Gdegayas. He's the son of somebody who was...
Every family in Libya. Every family in Libya has someone in the opposition. Libya is a big country, but the population is very small. We're talking about 5 million, okay? And there are so many Libyans in the UK and in America and in the rest of the world nowadays, and that there are so many who are actively involved in one way or another against Gaddafi, against the opposition of Gaddafi.
There's an ANC.
Sorry?
There's an ANC of Libya here, the African National Congress.
Well, there are many organizations. There isn't one, for example, there is the, nowadays, the Islamic organization are gaining a lot of supporters. The biggest Libyan opposition group. I'm just saying opposition for a lack of a better word, is the Muslim Brotherhood, the Libyan Muslim Brotherhood, for example. This is the biggest group in outside Libya. They had 83 members who have been released from prison recently. Two of them have been sentenced to death. One of them is a good friend of mine. And he was the head of the chemical department at the University of Benghazi. He was a professor. And the other one who was sentenced to death is also the head of the nuclear department in the University of Tripoli. So you're talking about educated people, you're talking about well-placed individuals in the community. They have suffered a lot through being through coming to the West. Many Libyans who have applied for asylum in this country, for example, and haven't worked for 5 or 6 weeks, used to have very good jobs back home.
5 or 6 years, I think.
I'm just saying the minimum. In some cases, 20 years in this country. I used to be a staff member in the University of Tripoli, for example. I'm an engineer by profession. Now I'm not an engineer. I haven't worked as an engineer for many years. So coming to the West wasn't, you know, an easy ride, if you like, but there was a lot of suffering, and we have to work against so much problems. And now that Libya is opening up, a lot are trying to return to Libya. A lot.
At the back.
Yeah, I've got quite a few thoughts on quite a few things, but I'll try and be brief.
I'm going to try and keep us to 4 o'clock as a finish time. I know Stephanie needs to go. So, as brief as you can.
Right. In terms of the kind of British-Libya relationship, it's not something I've really studied, but there are a number of incidents that really do make you wonder what's going on. I'm sure what's going on at the moment, that half of it must be oil and the economic relationship. That must be what's driving it. But, I mean, the incidents over the years that kind of I remember the whole way that Arthur Scarville was set up by British intelligence with Roger Windsor and the whole Libya connection then. There's the David Shaler's story about mm-hmm. how MI5 was MI6 were funding a Islamic terror group in Libya to blow up Gaddafi.
The same group that is now the
prescribed.
Prescribed, yes.
Right, and
the same group.
They gave them a load of money and they blew up the wrong people. There's his partner, Annie Machen. I'm not a fan of these two, of Shaler and her, but I heard a talk she gave recently that was on the internet from about, I don't know, 6 months ago. She was talking about Yvonne Fletcher, and I mean, her story is that the people that got sentenced for that had absolutely nothing to do with it. There are two people doing a lot of Palestine students doing a lot of Palestine solidarity work in London that were basically set up. And that whole incident she considers was actually a staged incident. I don't know whether
the
people convicted for the Lockerbie bombing are now being allowed to appeal, aren't they?
Mm.
So there's an awful lot of It appears to me that what's really going on behind the scenes is probably completely different to what we're being told by the media in terms of the British-Libya relationship.
Well, if you consider...
Changing the subject a bit. One aspect of kind of human rights that I think is quite pernicious in whether the Western governments use it is the extent to which countries that Britain or the US or another Western imperial power is about to bomb is usually condemned for all sorts of human rights abuses. And we saw that with Iraq. You look at the post-Second World War history of imperialism, and you know, every country before they're about to be attacked by the West, a lot of noise is made about human rights abuses in that country, and there are a number of human rights organisations that have come in for lots of criticism. Like, there's an essay a while ago written by Jonathan Cook, who's a British journalist based in Palestine, and he wrote an article about Human Rights Watch, about the extent to which there have been systematically and massively kind of pro-Israeli in terms of their coverage of human rights abuses in the Palestine-Israeli conflict. And I think this is one way in which the media and the government kind of win support for their kind of program of mass slaughter abroad, which is what we're seeing in Iraq. And I was wondering if anyone had any thoughts about that.
Can I just respond to one of those points, and then
sure. Bobby? Well, finally, I was just going to say the idea of doing this in a month of stuff around terror laws is a good idea, and
okay.
I'd like to get involved in that.
One of the points I've just picked up from what you said is the fact that at some point in the past, British, US officials, governments have been complicit in encouraging some of these groups or organisations, or we know the link between Afghanistan when Russia was ruling the country and people like Osama bin Laden, when the CIA poured money into these Islamist groups, etc. And the MI6 involvement in the attempted coup in Libya is another one. I don't know if you heard Bishr al-Rawi, his interview on Channel 4 News. He was an Iraqi citizen, a UK resident detained in Guantanamo, who's been released fairly recently, who, when you hear his story, he was encouraged by MI5 to have links, and I've forgotten with the name of the Muslim cleric who's... Abu Qatada.
It's in the Observer.
In the Observer as well. He was encouraged to have those links. He met with these officers. He shared information with them from those links. And then he finds himself taken from Gambia to Afghanistan to Guantanamo. And in Guantanamo, the same officers come and see him, still as MI5 officers, and interview him about his terrorist links.
Yeah.
And that's always part of the problem. My advice to clients of mine who MI5 want to interview, or special branches to interview, is you don't talk to them. and I have MI5 on the phone trying to remind me of my obligations as a British citizen in respect of national security, because I'm telling clients, no, you're not going to meet with them. It's not in your best interest to do so. And I think we should... that link between who is a friend at one point and who we're encouraging and who we then stab in the back is something that we can't forget. And some of these people, including, say, for example, the people arrested in Manchester, being encouraged to come along and talk to us. You know, share, you know, let's just use you. People get twisted into being informants, believing that maybe it will help their British nationality application, for example. And in reality, it won't. It never has done, in my experience.
I've seen a very cynical example of exactly that, where one of the... he's a Libyan national as well, and he was going to be deported to Libya, but he's being prosecuted at the moment. But he was contacted by MI5 because he knew of a person who MI5 thought could assist with the release of that man, Ken Bigley, who was assassinated. And he said he would try to see what he could do, but he didn't have the direct contact that they thought. But he would try and make inquiries. And that was... so he'd done that, whatever that was, 2 years ago. And that was relied upon as a justification for saying he was an Islamist extremist with links to Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And I couldn't believe that that's what they were prepared to say, but they were. And that's how cynical it is.
Bobby.
Yeah, I just something that really struck me in listening to what's been said today is that, in a sense, I mean, it's stating the obvious, really, in that actually the whole question of human rights is cannot be kind of... you can't have human rights just for one group of people. It is a question for the whole of humanity in that sense, and in a sense it's shown in the very principle of everyone has the same right, you know, in the face of the law. So everyone has the right to a fair trial. Everyone has the right to challenge their imprisonment, whoever, wherever you come from, etc. And it seems to me that it's absolutely essential, therefore, that a country like this can be a place of refuge for people who are struggling against regimes. Yeah, and in a sense, there has always been that tradition in this country. You know, you go... I mean, it's contradictory, but you go... you know, you can go right back to the... to the beginning of the 20th century, the end of the 19th century, you know, the Russian emigres come to this country. It seems to me that if we lose that here, for you know, I was around in the 80s when there were massive demonstrations to the ANC, and you know, we used to be outside the South African embassy picketing. Every night we held every day and every night there was a picket outside the South African embassy. We used to get the South African secret police standing there taking photographs of you, etc., etc. And there was connections made. If you lose that ability here, you lose it also for yourself. As a principle, it doesn't exist. There is, actually, the argument goes, why should it just exist for foreign nationals? Why should it just be for foreign nationals? It doesn't make sense. And I think, in a sense... The ideological logic of the attacks on human rights can be seen in the fact that you know, they won't even counting the Iraqi dead. You know, they don't have any value. They don't have any... not even the value of being counted. And I think, you know, and the way that you can get away with that, in a sense, is because we're dealing with foreigners. And I think that all this is happening, and there is a kind of... although there's been lots of gains, there is an insidious rise in racism going on in this country, I think. And people are going, well, what's it to do with me? You know, why do I care, and, you know, about what happens to these people? And I think one of the things that we must do, as well as, you know, carrying on the campaigns as it were, and it's important to note that the recent use of the terrorism laws were used against
those protesters in Heathrow. The Terrorism Act was used on those. And the rumours that were put in the press of people that they were going to leave empty cases in the airport to cause alarm, and they were putting all those things in. I think, I think it's also important that we really do expose what those things that are invisible, what happens to the families, to the children of people who are involved in these raids. Because even if a terrorist was arrested, and let's not forget what has happened to those people who were arrested in Birmingham, the raids in Birmingham, of the plot to behead a British soldier. What's happened to that? That's just disappeared. Disappeared off the face of the earth, that story. But even if they was a terrorist, the child is still a child that has not committed a crime. And it's so important that that child has the support and given the support in those situations. It is absolutely, a terrifying thing. And we must bring that to out in the open, it seems to me, to humanise it so that people see a human story, not a foreign.
Yeah, can I just say, you said, there's people would say, what have these leaders got to do with me, the man in the street? Well, I think we have to look at our lifestyle,
Yeah.
We drive about, we go to Tesco's, we want our strawberries flown in.
That's right.
And that needs a lot of energy. And when the energy was homegrown, it was coal fields around here, then the enemy was the working class. Now the enemy is an external enemy, and who happens to be a Muslim, because that's where 70% of the oil is. Our economy depends on that. Mm. And so, what does it matter? Well, it matters because it's the way we live that causes all of this shit.
I'm going to take one more comment or question, then ask Stephanie and Abisonders if there's anything they want to say in conclusion. Then I'm going to refer briefly to the CAMP Act proposal, and then we'll finish.
That's
your
two-part question. Very simple information I'm seeking.
Okay.
One is about hugs, because we haven't actually spoken a great deal about it.
Right.
And it would be good to know if there's that we would have been asked to do particular things had there been someone here. So what should we do about hugs?
Right.
I'm partly here because I'm very interested in this issue.
Can I answer that point first?
Yes, you can be. It's for Stephanie, and it's just to ask where I can find information about what is happening in other countries such as Europe and Australia on the battle for human rights, and whether we are doing particularly badly, which I feel we probably are from various evidences that I've had, as compared with other countries which are facing the same issues. So I have information about that. That was my two.
Yeah, just on the hugs thing, I'm going to suggest that, Bobby, you give the contact of Saida at Hugs in London to yourself. Hugs doesn't exist in Sheffield. When we were asking Emma, who's in Manchester, for a Hugs speaker from Sheffield, she said our closest speaker in Halifax, but they've been arrested under anti-terrorism legislation. So there isn't a Hugs in Sheffield, that's one thing, although presumably there are families being affected. They're there to give assistance to those families that are, for example, families of Guantanamo detainees or others under anti-terrorism legislation, control orders or whatever. But if Bobby can put you in touch with Saida, who probably will put you in touch with Emma, perhaps when she's more on her feet. I know that in Manchester, for example, they look for people to take the women to visit the men in the prison. They're looking for practical support and assistance to overcome some of these issues. Stephanie, and the other.
Thank you.
I think that the best source of information, comparative information about other practices abroad, is from Amnesty. They've done a lot of work on actually using it to illustrate how the United Kingdom's measures are much more extreme and intrusive of rights than other European countries, and they've done a lot of analysis that compares what's happening elsewhere. So I think Amnesty is probably the best.
Can I add to that, though, the Institute of Race Relations in London? Liz Fakiti, in particular, the Assistant Director of the Institute of Race Relations, just IRR, and he said IRA then, IRR.org, I think, would be the thing. Liz Fakiti, in particular, has done a lot of work about anti-terrorism measures across Europe and attack... Institute of... Well, just the Institute of Race Relations. Liz Fakiti. F-E-K-E-T-E. K-E-T-E. Produce a lot of information about what is going on across Europe.
Thank you very much.
In that sense. Stephanie, is there anything you want to say?
I think that it's probably right to emphasise that this legislation has been aimed at particular groups, and particular groups have been disproportionately affected. But the point that Bobby made is the right one, that once legislation is on the statute book, it can be applied wherever, whenever, and that increasingly the anti-terrorism legislation is being used to police protest in a broad sense, so that all the major demonstrations against that have been taking place related to the war, like, for example, at Fairford, the recent, as you said, at Heathrow, the climate change camp, the police are using the powers under Section 44 of the Terrorism Act. There was a protest against an arms deal, an arms fair, sorry, in Docklands. Again, the police used those powers to stop and search. And they don't have the same dramatic effects as the raids that we're talking about and the arrests and the imprisonments that are taking place. But they do mean that people who would want to exercise their rights to protest are being subject to these extraordinary measures where they can be stopped and searched just because they're going to attend a demonstration, and it can be held, can be told that they can't go there, escorted back to London, etc., etc., or wherever they're coming from. So I think that is the message, that unless we are prepared to say it's unacceptable for anybody to be subject to these measures, they're going to become part and parcel of the ordinary powers of the police instead of what they are, extraordinary powers that make significant inroads into long thought out, well established rights.
Absolutely.
Yes. Now, with regard to some points that have been raised generally, my feeling is that the campaign by America and and Britain is a dreamt up, made up one. It's not real. The threat of terrorism is not really that real at all. I don't know about the seven of the seven, and there never was a public inquiry into that, and we don't really know exactly what happened. Maybe these were misguided youths for one reason or another who did something that is, they shouldn't have done something that is unacceptable. But definitely the shift from the time when Russia and communism was the enemy and the Cold War to the fact that now there is no enemy, and the powers that be cannot live without an enemy. There needs to be an enemy. So they were looking desperately for an enemy. They found one in Islam and in the Islamists. And one of the things that sometimes gets me very angry is when we, the Muslim community living in Britain, are being asked to engage, for example, just as an example. And then when we try to engage, every time something happens, the government starts to focus on the Muslims and, you know, try to engage. Who do you think they sent to us? Always the Home Office, the police, special branch. They never send us people from the National Health Service. They never send us people from the Education Department. They never send us anyone from the Foreign Secretary. Why aren't there Muslims working in the embassies in the British embassies in the world? Why isn't there an Arab ambassador, for example, in the Arab world? Why is it still a tight club? What has the government done to facilitate this engagement? Nothing. So this engagement, to me, the government is talking about, it gives me a message: the government doesn't want us to engage. It's not the, even the message, we want you to engage, but in reality they don't. Because we are engaging, because we, it's slowly happening, but if you go back a number of years, for example, the Muslim community here in this country was forced to be isolated, not out of choice, but out of a number of reasons. First of all, they were very poor, they were illiterate, they were laborers, most of them. Britain was Great Britain at that time, and no Englishman would be caught dead socializing with a Pakistani. In fact, they went around pashing. Okay, these are the realities. The number of years, it suited the whole government, the system of, you know, everyone keeps his own. But now suddenly there's a shift and there's a change, and that change requires this, requires these. Chomsky, for example, says that it's in the interest of each country to let its people live at a heightened stage of fear, so that they will be able to pass the legislations that the politicians want. And therefore, this staged state of fear, if you go through the airports, it's ridiculous, the 100 milliliters of liquid in plastic bags. The other day, I passed through and forgot I had some liquids in my bag, and you know, I passed through the machine and everything, and he made me go and buy some plastic bags, two bags for 50 pence, and then he took one of them and he just put the bottle in it, and he tried to close it, he couldn't close it, he just threw it, and that's it. And it was ridiculous, really. It served no purpose at all, no purpose except to, you know, keep us sort of on edge. You know, there is an enemy out there, and unfortunately. The other thing, okay, I'll stop here.
I was just going to say that it's a useful point in which just to read to you the proposal from the. Okay. We thank Stephanie and Abu Sanders for their extremely welcome contribution. Just to finish, the proposal from the Campaign Against Criminalising Communities, which came out of the 2000 Act, and I'll just read the first paragraph. The proposal is for activists and organisations involved in defending civil society against the politics of fear and insecurity, which you've just spoken about, unleashed by the anti-terror laws. We propose a month of collective action throughout the country to engage people at local level and at parliamentary level. We aim to build a coalition of civil liberties, activists, migrant groups, Muslim groups, lawyers, journalists, academics, trade unions, environmental campaigners, amongst others. And it's an invitation to join that campaign. Peace and Progress is already part of it. By asking you to be part of this, I'm not asking you to be part of Peace and Progress. I love to have people join Peace and Progress, apart from make good use of your membership fee. That's not the point. The point is to form this coalition, so that whatever group you are part of or are not part of, the actual number of people working against this increasing encroachment on human rights grows ever wider. Thank you very much for coming today. It's good to see you. It's a pity we didn't have more, but I think it's quality rather than quantity, as ever. Thank you very much. Oh, and can I just say, if you want to make a contribution to HUGS, there's either a basket or a green tin on the where the Peace and Progress material is. Please take the material. Anything you give goes to HUGS. Thank you very much.
There's also an information pack about HUGS.
Okay. It's on the table, I think.
On the table there.